Welcome to another exciting issue of Launch, where we talk with entrepreneurs and with inventors and those that help both of those on their journey. I'm here with my producer, Lee Cantor. How you doing, Lee?
I am doing okay. Big show today. Got a big celebrity. Celebrity in town.
That's right. And he's not big in width, but he's big in stature.
That's what I meant.
Height. He's tall. Yes. Today we have Michael Blake. Mike is the co-founder of Startup Lounge, which is a 501c6 nonprofit here in Atlanta. And their mission is to support the growth and development of innovation-driven ventures here in Georgia and all around the Southeast. Mike's had I consider Mike to be a renaissance man. His careers included 6 years in defense conversion and venture capital in the U.S., Russia, and Ukraine, 2 years of technology investment banking in Israel and the U.S. For the past 5 years, he's been a business appraiser. His day job is a director of valuation services at Habit, Arogeti and Wynn, which is the largest independent accounting firm here in the U.S. But it's the off hours that gets me interested. Not only is he an avid baseball fan and has a blog that he frequently writes on baseball topics, but that blog is called Unblakeable. He also plays keyboard for Harvey Nation, which is a heavy metal funk band based in Chamblee. So welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks very much.
I'm telling you what, what do you do in your spare time, okay?
You know, why bother having spare time? You know, my wife gets on because I hate sleeping. I mean, there are people in the world who love sleeping. I hate it. If there were a genie who could come in and give me one wish, it would be to eliminate my need to sleep and free up those extra 5-6 hours a day.
How about that? Well, I've always heard it's better to wear out than rust out.
Exactly right.
Okay. The Startup Lounge, now is that a place where people get their batteries recharged, or what is that?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. They either get them recharged or utterly drained, depending on who you talk to, I think. You know, Startup Lounge is, it started off really just as an idea, or my co-founder Scott Burkett and I said, you know, there are things that we don't think Atlanta does very well as an ecosystem, so to help innovation-driven ventures. So what can we do to help? And it started with a podcast, actually, in a studio not unlike this one. And from then, it sort of grew into an actual organization. It's become a virtual meeting place and a virtual platform, if you will, for early stage entrepreneurs to get the help and support they need, and for early stage investors to have a safe environment to find good deal flow and to engage in the community.
So how does Startup Lounge work?
Well, it's even an open question if it works, but it's really a group of us, and Scott and I guess are the community leaders, but it comprises 2,000 companies, you know, by the latest count. And our podcast has about 18,000 subscribers, and really it's just a community, and we do a few things. You know, we have our podcast and we bring on successful entrepreneurs, we bring on angel investors and other subject matter experts to really dig deep into topics that we hope entrepreneurs can listen to and take with them either motivationally or mechanically to help them build their businesses and give them information that is difficult to get elsewhere. And for me, that's a way of giving back, because when I got my start in venture capital, I worked for a guy named Lee Stein at Scott Evely Associates, and I carried his briefcase around. And it was because somebody took me under his wing that I learned the venture capital market at all. And I think that's the way you have to learn. You have to learn from people who've done it. And so Startup Lounge is a way of creating that community so people can learn from others who've done it.
How about that? You're talking about carrying the briefcase around. I remember many, many years ago, Aristotle Onassis was interviewed, and they said, what if you lost it all? What would you do? And he said that he'd become a waiter at some of the fanciest restaurants in Paris. And he would listen to what the people with money were doing with their money. And he would save his tips and invest in that, and he would rebuild everything that he had. So it's kind of like you just carried the briefcase, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Now, I didn't do as well as he did investing-wise, but I'm still learning.
Okay. So I know that the events that you have, people like me, I'm a patent agent, we're persona non grata. We can't come. Who are the people that get invited?
Well, we invite people who are entrepreneurs, who are active angel investors, and we invite, actually could come as media, but we invite people from media, from government, from academia, from from like-minded nonprofits. It's just designed to be a meeting place. And like, I'm a service provider in my day job too. So it's not so much that it's persona non grata, rather that there are many organizations in town where in our service provider persona, we can go and meet entrepreneurs and meet angel investors, and they can meet us if they want to. But that changes the dynamic of the conversation, because when entrepreneurs, when people are out in the market and they think they're going to be sold to, they're defensive, they're closed, they're not doing the same things that they're doing in kind of a more, I guess, kind of controlled environment, if you will. So the point of Startup Lounge was to create that sterile environment so that entrepreneurs and investors would not feel like targets, but rather they could be in that environment where they can have the kind of conversations and in-depth conversations and know there's a high likelihood they can meet exactly the kind of people they're sending out to me in that given night.
Okay. Well, Lee, since now I can put on my media hat.
Oh, there you go. Changes the game.
Yeah, here's another reason why people should have a radio show, right?
Exactly. To get into these kind of events.
That's right. So I won't go as a Ron Reardon patent agent, but Ron Reardon, the host of co-host of the radio show.
Now, Michael, can you talk a little bit about the podcast? Because you do it in a little different way. Most people think that we're an ADD nation that needs only like 1 minute little clips, and your show's kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, most podcasts are 5-10 minutes at most, and ours is a good hour and a half. And it's funny, we've had people who've asked us to transcribe the podcast because it'd be easier
to read it than listen to it necessarily.
But we decided that we wanted to. How can I put this? You can get a 5-second sound bite without our help.
Right. Right?
There are quotes in the Atlanta Business Chronicle. There are blogs. People stand up in front of audiences and talk about what they do. There are panel discussions. You can get the 30-second elevator pitch anytime you want. But what we want to do is we want to ask the 20 questions that a typical entrepreneur, if they had their one shot to, say, meet Gordon Rogers of the Atlanta Technology Angels or Mitch Freeman at MFG.com, they had a real sit-down conversation to learn about what they do, how they do it, how they did it, why they're successful, what mistakes they've made. That takes a long time.
Right.
Now, the beauty of a podcast, you can fast-forward back and forth between various moments.
Right.
So if you don't want to listen to Scott's and my banter, and I'm sure most don't, that you can go right to the material and you can listen to that part of the discussion that is most interesting to you.
Now, how much preparation do you put into these? Because an hour and a half, is it something you're just winging and trying to be like the listener and ask the questions that they would be interested in? Or are you digging deep and, being like Charlie Rose and breaking out books that they wrote 6 years ago and pulling quotes out?
Well, we're not real journalists, right? I mean, we're a couple
right.
of knuckleheads, and we're amateurs. But early on, we decided one thing is that we're not going to be Mike Wallace.
We're not going to jump somebody
on the program
right.
and say, here's your 1986 tax return. Or,
right.
Do you know the woman in this photograph? It sure seems like she knows you. I mean, you can do that once, and then you'll never get a guest again. And that's not really the point. But the point is we do like having people listen to our podcast.
Right.
We try to put ourselves in the shoes of why would somebody want to listen to this? And so the preparation, there is some preparation involved. We send the questions to the person in advance. Again, we don't want to surprise them. And,
right.
and they may suggest questions that are better for us to ask, or they may ask us not to ask certain questions.
Right.
And that's fine. There's a lot of pre- and post-production that Scott does, all the sound effects and the
right.
the podcast-safe songs that we have in the intermission. That's all him.
Right.
We collect email. We have people actually send us questions they'd like us to answer on the air, and that all goes into the show. So there's probably about 3 hours of pre-production time and about 10 to 15 hours of post-production time. The magic of editing.
Right.
When people hear us actually do the podcast, the blood drains out of their face. They don't realize what jerks we are because they only hear the edited version. But someday we think we're going to have a close circle of friends with some alcohol involved in some undisclosed location and go through the outtakes. But some of the things we've said, we're very glad never made it beyond that room.
Yep. Well, I know that I tell folks that when you're starting a new venture, about 10% of your efforts are really going to pay off, and 90%, nothing happens. When I'm listening to a podcast like what you would have, I want to know what they did wrong. What did they do that, you know, got no results at all? I mean, it's always great to hear, yeah, I did this and I became a gazillionaire. But, you know, well, what did you do that didn't work? That's what I want to know.
You know, one of the great learning experiences talking to venture capitalists and angel investors is the war stories.
Right.
Because they've all lost money. Sig Mosley has lost money. Stephen Fleming's lost money. Charlie Paparelli's lost money. Now they've made more than they've lost. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep doing it. But, you know, the education to be an investor is very expensive. The education to be an entrepreneur is very expensive. You know, it may take you 3-4 deals before you hit one that even hits a replacement salary level, let alone be a, you know, a viable exit. And you're right, because very clearly in hindsight those mistakes become visible. But at the time, you know, it's not always easy to see.
That's correct. You know, my wife tells me frequently, "Boy, you sure have had an expensive education." But because I've put money into stuff and no results. But
yep.
Then luckily I've done enough things right, you know, that it's paid off.
Well, the good news, if it works right, you only need to have one or two things go right, and they make up for 10 things or 5 things that go wrong. That's the theory, anyway.
Yeah. So what do you actually get from Startup Lounge?
We enjoy doing it. You know, we're hobbyists and we're venture communists. I mean, it's you know, we don't none of us draw any kind of salary, don't draw any kind of compensation. Scott and I just, you know, like Mark Twain once wrote, everybody complains about the weather, nobody does anything about it.
Correct.
And so we wanted to do something about it, and we're delighted that there have been some really neat changes that have been occurring in the Atlanta ecosystem. We think make it a much more friendly place to start and to cultivate an innovation-driven venture. But, you know, it's the email from somebody who says, you know, we got our first funding, we got our first customer, and thank you so much for making that happen. Or the email from the entrepreneur says, you know, I've been banging my head against the wall, and I've got 3 contusions on the side of my head, 2 from the wall, 1 from my wife, and thank you for telling me to stop this thing, because it was destroying my marriage and I couldn't go anywhere. But none of my friends would tell me that I was crazy and would tell me to stop. They thought they were doing me a favor by egging me on.
Right. And that's a hard call sometime of when to start and when to keep going and then when to stop.
That's a great point. In fact, my wife has been saying we should do a show like that, actually, because I think that is the hardest. You know, at what point are you just drinking your own Kool-Aid? You know, there's a point, there's evangelism and there's fanaticism, and it's difficult to understand where the line is.
Well, you know, when you stop, then you're done. But if you keep going, you may succeed.
You may succeed, but if the probability is low, or, you know, it may be zero. I mean, there are businesses where the probability of success is zero,
right,
but you just don't see it.
Yeah, because, you know, I've read so many stories of folks that were right there at the point of just, you know, walking away from it, and the next day they get the phone call that changes everything. But, you know, what if you don't get that phone call?
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of mythology in business. You know, there's a lot of those stories that people tell after that it happened that, oh, that was an amazing rags to riches story, like you just said, one magic phone call. And do you typically find that it's just one defining moment that, you know, makes something successful or not?
Well, you know, I'm a good to great guy. In that the thesis of that book is that you build a company with lots of little successes that gather momentum over a period of time, and then it only becomes visible to the outside at one flashpoint. The first chess world champion, a guy by the name of Anderson, wrote a book that said you don't win a game of chess with one move. You win it in the 20 moves leading up to that one move by building small advantages over time. It seems more compressed, perhaps, and more visible at the venture point, but unless you've done something right, when that phone call either A, never comes, or B, when it comes, you're not in a position to take advantage of it.
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple in town that their first venture failed miserably, and they had to walk away from it. It involved a big, complicated machine, you know, for salons, and then their second venture involved something that was a lot less expensive. But they put a lot of effort into it, went to a lot of trade shows and everything, and it gotten to the point where they said, you know, we've given it our best shot, you know, let's forget it. But they had hired somebody to do publicity for them, and this person had been working to get them on the Oprah show. And all of a sudden, you know, the phone call came in from Harpo Productions saying, can you be in Chicago on Saturday? And, of course, everything changed.
Sure.
So, yeah, they had one that failed. Second one, they were ready to walk away. And then, bingo, it all changed.
My son takes karate, and he just earned his first belt. I think it's a yellow belt. And, you know, watching the ceremony, his instructor said something that has really resonated with me. And he said that a black belt is a white belt who never gave up.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's
and great. To me, that's very profound.
Yeah, that's great.
And I don't know anything about karate. Like, I don't even watch the Kung Fu movies. So, but there's something to be said for that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Startup Lounge started back in 2006, and I know that almost any venture kind of morphs and changes and it gets tweaked as things go on. What's different now with Startup Lounge than back in 2006?
Well, one thing we've really tried hard to do is not make it about the cult personality of Scott and Mike. You know, we're narcissists, but to an extent. The reality is that it has to become scalable. It's gotten to a point where we can't do it all of ourselves. And I have a demanding day job. Scott has a demanding day job. He has two daughters. I have a son. You know, we have many demands on our time, but we're still very dedicated to the cause. And what we learned is that we've got to delegate. We've got to enroll more people who think like we do, that want to be part of building this new establishment. And so, you know, we've pretty much offloaded Angel Lounge to Charlie Paparelli, who's one of the most important angels in town, and Ann Simons, who's a brilliant marketing researcher and a Harvard graduate, has taken over all of our corporate communications and just did a very in-depth survey of our community. Stacy Shuker has been very helpful to us, and it's about letting go and delegating. And you know, we're actually going to have, it looks like we're going to have a franchise of Startup Lounge up in Research Triangle. They approached us late last year and said, "Hey, we really buy what you guys are selling." So we're not selling anything. But if you want to do it, that's fine.
Right.
You just got to make sure that you uphold the Startup Lounge
standard
manifesto.
That's correct.
Basically,
it's not that simple.
and it's interesting because you know the it's deceptively difficult.
Right.
To
it looks
exclude
easy.
Exclude people. You know, Atlanta's a funny town. If you say no to somebody in this town, you're a jerk. It doesn't matter what you say no to, but if you say no to people, it gets around, and you know, here's Dr. No, and here's a guy that's a real jerk, right? And that's not healthy. You know, no is a healthy thing, and they experience the exact same thing up there. It's sort of digressing, but that's one of the things we've learned through Startup Lounge is that most of the country is like us. It's Silicon Valley and Boston that are the anomalies, but the rest of the country is like us. That's why people come from Michigan and Colorado and New York to come to our events.
How do you see the Atlanta market? You know, is it where you'd like it to be in terms of innovation? I know that's one of your missions is to kind of expand this market in this area for startups.
Yeah, it is. In fact, another thing to answer Ron's question is we are focusing on getting outside of Atlanta. You know, all of our work has been focused inside of Atlanta, and we're working with the state of Georgia and some people in other organizations to replicate Startup Lounge in other urban areas like Savannah and Augusta and Columbus that actually have quite a bit of wealth. And Savannah has a surprisingly vibrant angel community, but they need some focal point to bring critical mass to that community. Now, I can't go to Savannah and start something. I'm a carpetbagger by Atlanta standards. You can only imagine what they think of me in Savannah. So I can't tell them how to do it, or I can't do it for them. But if there's an organization or a set of people that want to replicate it there, then we'll give them all the support we can.
Yeah.
We think Atlanta has changed very much for the better. The victim mentality has receded. The you can't get funding mentality has received. In fact, you know, lots of deals are getting funded. It's just we don't blab about it. We don't feel like we've got to be on, you know, red herring or business 2.0 or anything else.
Right.
And I wrote you a check. Great. You know, let's go try to make a business. We're just not that way. So the community now is turning in on itself and saying, what can we do to help each other make better businesses rather than then whine and carp and moan about you can't get funding. You know, a good entrepreneur says, well, screw the funding.
We'll make it happen.
We're going to make it happen, right. However. And if it takes longer, it takes longer. But
isn't part of like the Silicon Valley community is the fact that people go from startup to startup to startup? Like you can fail and move on fairly easily?
They do. I mean, you know, Silicon Valley is
the exception,
an anomaly.
Right.
You know, they've had venture capital since 1946. Boston's had venture capital since 1946. We've really had it since 1988.
Right.
And so that's a two-generation gap.
Head start, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, part of this, you can't rush it. Like,
right.
You can put a steak in a microwave, and you can have a steak in 2 minutes, but it's not going to taste like the same steak that you slow grilled for 20 minutes.
Right.
So part of it is just time. When you accelerate it, you don't necessarily get what you think that you're going to get.
Yeah, well, it's good to hear that you're scaling it and delegating. I wrote a paper, I guess, around 2003 or 2004 of what happens to any business if you try to maintain control. It basically implodes and you go off the cliff. You've got to let go of control and let other folks do stuff.
Yeah, and that's especially true because, you know, there's no profit motive here. I mean, there's not even, you know, there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It's really about creating sustainability behind the mission. It's got to be beyond Scott. And the day's going to come where we're going to get burned out. Hasn't come yet. Don't see it coming. But the day's going to come where somebody's got to take this thing over. And in the meantime, we've got to build an organization that is robust enough that it can sustain itself, again, beyond the personalities of the guys that founded it.
Yeah, I know. I went to one networking event where the fella started off his talk saying, what's the first question you should ask before starting a business? And his answer was, how are you going to exit the business? And I always thought that was kind of an interesting twist. I mean, you're just starting and you're thinking about, you know, how am I leaving this, you know?
I agree with that because when I tell people about writing business plans, I tell them start from the end and work your way backward, because the exit is what does my business need to look like in order to exit, and then you build your plan step by step backwards to get it to look like that.
Right.
Yeah, you know, when I joined Toastmasters, that was one of the first things they told me about giving a speech is, you know, what's the last thing you're going to say, and then work your way backwards from that. So it's kind of the same principle.
They do weird things in Toastmasters, don't they?
Yes, they do.
I knew somebody, a dear friend of mine, who was told to lie on the floor and mimic being cooked like a slice of bacon.
I've not seen that.
That's
the
advanced
Toastmasters.
Those are advanced.
It must be very advanced. But no, some Toastmasters clubs will have a little clicker, and every time you say the word or ah, they'll go click, you know, which totally throws you off your speech.
I'll bet.
But the objective is for you to have no uhs and ahs, you know, in your presentation. But that's the only weird, and I've heard that they'd have a big tin can with a little steel ball, and if you said or ah, they go pong.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But
Very psychological.
But other kinder, gentler Toastmaster clubs, they'll simply just keep a count, and when they give the evaluation, they say, well, Ron, you had 23 uhs, you know, and that's a lot better than the clicker or the ball in the can. But what would you do better at Startup Lounge?
You know, we got to do better communicating. We've been okay. We get word out to the community, I'd say, just in time. We got to do better about getting it out more than just in time. And we get our events filled. People know what's going on. But we really should give them more notice than we've been giving. You know, second, I think we need to do a better job of educating entrepreneurs on how to build businesses themselves. And that's why we've started our startup seminar series this year, which your partner,
Jim DeBell,
had great success with. I mean, it was just a smashing success. The emails poured in, other emails saying, oh, dude, I can't believe I missed it. When is he going to come on again? So he'll be invited back, assuming he wants to do it. But
Jim knows his stuff.
Oh, boy, does he ever. And it's such a rare topic, too. You know, not many people have been a buyer for a major retail chain and don't really know how that system works. And Jim did a great job. So we're going to be doing more seminars like that. And in March, we have a QD CFO is going to come on and lead a workshop on building a financial model for the early stage venture. So you'll walk out with the basics of a financial model that day. We'll have somebody come in. I think from Ballard Spahr is going to come in and talk about intellectual property basics. How do you start protecting your IP before you hire the $500 an hour attorney? We'll have somebody come in and talk about corporate structure, about hiring, about how do you work with outsourced IT and programming providers, you know, real nuts and bolts, business building kind of topics that otherwise the entrepreneurs either don't know the answers to or would cost them a lot of money to hire a consultant to try to solve.
Yeah. Is Georgia Tech involved in all this? How, and if they are, how much?
Well, I'd say tangentially. I mean, we're on friendly terms with the Georgia Tech folks. They know who we are. ATDC is a media sponsor, so they get our information out to all of their folks. But we work closely with Georgia Tech, with UGA. We're building bridges with Georgia State. Their entrepreneurship program is very embryonic right now.
Kennesaw State?
What's this?
Is Kennesaw State?
No.
No? Is that,
should they be?
I don't know. Should they be? They have an entrepreneurial program?
You know, they have the SBDC over there. And, you know, I've had some conversations with them. They really haven't gone anywhere. Mm-hmm. But, you know, any place where there's entrepreneurship, one of Scott's passions in particular is exposing students to entrepreneurship as a career path.
Right.
And that's one of the big differences between us and a Silicon Valley is many entrepreneurs are my age, late 30s, as opposed to late teens, early 20s, when a lot of the ventures get started.
What do you think are the pros and cons of that?
Well, the pros of that is that it gives you a chance to fail 2-3 times
right
before you hit it big, because you're earlier in your life cycle and your earning cycle. And so the cost of failure also is less because you've forgone ostensibly less salary to do so. The cons are an issue really of risk tolerance. If you go into engineering, chances are very good you're not a big risk taker, which is a good thing, by the
right
way. I like to have obsessive compulsive bridge designers,
right? Yeah,
and aircraft designers. You know, I'd like them to not be risk takers. But at the same time, if you're going to take the risk, the time to do that is when you're 19 and mom and dad are paying for room and board.
Right. You've got nothing to lose, right?
And you've got a whole university around you with all these research facilities and bright minds and computer resources and whatnot that you can basically use at no additional marginal cost. So if we can create the path of entrepreneurship from a career development standpoint, it's a total game changer culturally. We don't have that yet.
I was a physics major, which is kind of a cousin to engineers. My risk tolerance was extremely low, and I had a 32-year career with Bell South. Okay, just staying safe,
right,
warm in a chair. And I would look at people that started their own business, and I'd just be mystified about how could they have the courage to do that? No floor, no ceiling, And I think that mentally, I wasn't prepared to be an entrepreneur and have a business until, I mentally had changed, inside my head. So to do that at 19, would be unthinkable for me, but not for others.
Yeah, for me also. I think if you look at the psychological profile of the typical entrepreneur, they don't perceive risk the way that we do. They perceive risk as a problem that can be solved, whereas somebody like you back in the day and I would have perceived risk as just something catastrophic that could go wrong and be life ruining.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same problem, but the entrepreneur, instead of trying to run away from that risk, jumps on top of it like it's a wild fire hose and tries to wrestle it to the ground. And sometimes they do, and sometimes it hits them in the head and they get a concussion.
Yeah. Well, I know what helped me is I started off doing some whitewater canoeing and then advanced to whitewater kayaking. And some people says, you're absolutely bonkers to be in this little boat going down these rapids where you could, if you turn over, your head gets smashed against the rocks like that. But I learned that once you had the skill of knowing how to maneuver the boat and how to get the boat back upright, it was a risk, but I considered it a calculated risk where the odds were good.
Yeah, well, because, the risk, instead of something bad happening to you, is the risk of you screwing up.
That's right.
Basically. And that's a different kind of risk.
Yeah, and I've come out of the boat and swam through some rapids before, too. And I survived,
Again, that's risk management right there, right?
That's right. So how many companies do you think that you've helped with Startup Lounge?
Well, it's been reported to us that 10 have received funding through Startup Lounge. And the biggest one, actually, realized through the survey I talked about, was $5 million of financing, which was just astonishing. We thought the record was 1.5. Everybody thinks there's no capital out there. I'm here to tell you that it is. But based on the emails that we get and the handshakes we get out in the community, I'd like to think we've helped hundreds of companies in some fashion, whether it's simply giving them hope that they're not alone, whether it's motivational, whether there's an actual tool they can use. We've put probably 2,500 people just through the Startup Lounge Atlanta, this formerly known as Capital Lounge event. We've put well over 100 people through Pitch Camp. So I don't know if we've helped all those people, but at least we've given them a place to go.
Okay. Was there any kind of details you can give us on a Startup Lounge success story?
There are a couple really interesting ones. One is a movie that got funded, believe it or not. Rick Cohen, who actually filmed the video that's on the Startup Lounge site about one of our events, he has a movie called Faded Glory, which is a documentary about a reunion of an amateur baseball team for which he played 15 years later, and they went on to this senior or old guys amateur baseball championships or something, and it's getting some traction in Hollywood.
Wow, that's cool.
And an investor that he met at Startup Lounge Atlanta put the money in his company required to finish production.
I think I've heard about that movie here recently.
Yeah, it's won tons of awards.
Oh, okay.
So he's just done a terrific job with it.
So startups define it's defined in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it is, and it's funny because Scott and I are in a position of playing a little bit of God, which makes us very uncomfortable. But how do we do that in terms of deciding who is going to be invited to our event and who isn't? And we have to make a decision based on, are they really an entrepreneur? Or are they just a service provider trying to get in? Are they the kind of entrepreneur that would be of realistic interest to the investors that are in that room? And that's tough because 4 of the 10 deals that have been funded were consumer products, which we never would have guessed. I don't know anything about consumer products, nor does Scott. I mean, we're both technology guys. But we've had heated arguments over who to who to let in.
It's like the draft board in the NFL.
Oh, yeah. not even as civil as that. one of us throwing down our headphones and Skyping and saying, F you. And then we'll come back and revisit it. But what we've learned is that we don't want to pick the deals. We want to just find companies that seem like they'd be of interest to the investor community. And if we hadn't had that kind of open-mindedness, there's 4 deals and never would have gotten funded.
Yeah, and that's when I talk about, how ventures kind of morph as time goes on. When you started off, you're probably just thinking technology, and now it's kind of changed to include baseball movies.
Yeah, well, movies, plays, records, and that's just a different kind of entrepreneurship.
Sure.
It's an investment in media. And maybe it's a better investment. I don't know. I mean, the venture capital returns for the last 10 years have been terrible.
True. Well, it's 2010. We're here at the beginning. What's your vision for Startup Lounge for the rest of the year?
Smaller, more focused, and less about the funding conversation. We feel like the funding conversation is more or less over. It's been demonstrated. You can get deals funded in Atlanta, in Georgia, if they are very good deals. The investors are out there. I know. I meet them. I talk to them every day. I have lunch with them every month at Angel Lounge. They come to Startup Lounge Atlanta. So, when an entrepreneur tells me you can't get funded, I just don't buy. And by the way, the Atlanta Technology Angels are back open for business under their new leadership, which is just tremendous news. So what do we do next then? Because we started off saying, where's the beef? Where are the investors?
Where's the money, right?
Yeah, where are they at? And the conclusion we've arrived at now is that there are not enough investable companies in Atlanta.
So it's kind of flipped. So before the money was the problem, and now it's the startup that's the problem.
Yeah, well, not the problem, because I think that implies blame. But the area where we can have the most impact in building a vibrant ecosystem is taking the companies that are out there being built today and figure out how can we make them better. And sometimes that's with funding. Many times it's without funding. Can we help teach them how to sell their product? Can we help teach them how to hire correctly and not to do things that kill their companies or paralyze them with fear and indecision, so they just never move forward, or convince them to give up their current idea and start thinking of the next one. So, I mean, it sounds very trite. I almost want to hit myself.
But it sounds like you're taking more of an advisor role rather than before it was like kind of a matchmaker role.
Yeah, and a community focus role. In other words, you know, the thing we're most proud of at Startup Lounge is how we've gotten the angel investors to reengage in the community. If you think back 3-4 years ago, they were rarely seen. And everybody thought you basically had to send a deal to SIG, to Stephen Fleming, to the ATA. And if those three didn't fund it, you're basically done. Dead in the
right.
water, right?
Yeah.
Wow, that was fast. Great. I think I'll go get a job now.
Right.
That's changed. And the investors have come out. They're mentoring at Pitch Camp. They are coming to Startup Lounge and being helpful. They're offering themselves as mentors in other capacities. They're coming on our podcast. They're coming out into the community. And that's the most important thing, because Scott and I can rail all we want. But boy, oh boy, you really listen to a guy who writes checks.
Yes.
Very carefully.
Very attentively.
And I ain't a check writer. Scott ain't a check writer. But when those guys who do write checks say, you ought to do A, B, and C, you know, all of a sudden they're taking notes much more diligently.
Now, is this something that that the angel people and the VCs are getting more involved because, like you said, that they haven't been doing well, that they feel they have to get involved more?
I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is they've been looking for a safe platform to do so. You know, an angel investor out in the open is a target. And they're a target of entrepreneurs, you know, of unsolicited deal flow, most of which is not interesting to them. And they're targets of people like me, service providers, that want to sell them accounting and tax and valuation services. And after a while, they just says, no. You know, I'm living up in Johns Creek, and you're telling me I got to travel down 400 to 75 Fifth Street so I can have Blake, you know, stuff business cards in my pocket. I'm not interested in doing it, so I'm just going to withdraw. So I think, you know, Startup Lounge has provided that safe environment that says you can come out and you're not going to be a target. And what has happened is when that safe environment has been presented, the investors can't wait to get involved. We're oversubscribed right now for mentors for our next pitch camp.
That is wonderful.
It's terrific. That, really a credit to them.
Yeah, because, you know, that transfer of information, you know, from the investor to the entrepreneur is really, really valuable. I know that a lot of folks that I deal with, you know, let's say I've got an idea on a napkin, and I'll how do I go get money? And they think they can just take the napkin to an investor and they're going to write a check the first time they meet them, and it just doesn't happen that way. And so if the investors can, you know, transfer that information to the entrepreneurs of here's the process by which you can get the check written, that's worth a gazillion dollars right there.
It's interesting you say that, because there's a guy, I've been a very good friend of mine whom I've been mentoring for a long time, and he's had a term sheet on the table for a year. And they're negotiating it back and forth. And, of course, my friend who's the entrepreneur, the term sheet's one of the most important things in his life. So he turns things around in about 2 minutes.
Right.
The investor, who is, you know, sitting on 18 boards and has a day job and goes on vacations and stuff, this is priority number 62.
Right.
So the turnaround from him is about, you know, every 12, 14 weeks or so. It's interesting when you kind of see that disconnect, and you have to, as a mentor, you just try to talk the guy you're coaching back from the ledge.
Right.
Know?
It's managing the expectations.
That's right.
You know, just because it's important to you doesn't mean it's important to somebody else.
That's right. And that's why it's so important just to keep on executing. Assume you'll never get a dime of that and just go out and build the business.
Right. Move the ball.
And the best way to punish him, if that's the way you want to take it, is develop the business so much that by the time
you
finally get around,
right,
you don't need them.
Yeah, yep. Thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, exactly right.
Right.
Yeah, you know, the American Bar Association put out a little booklet. Basically, folks don't focused on intellectual property, but it was towards entrepreneurs. And they said the two expectations that are off the mark for entrepreneurs is they don't. It's going to take longer than they think. Okay, and it's going to take more money than they think to actually, you know, get the business to succeed.
Well, you know, it does. I mean, if there aren't many successful pessimistic entrepreneurs, you know, by definition, you're an optimist and you think everything's going to work out great. But part of that skill set is how do you work around things when they don't work out as planned?
That's right. How do you respond to that? So how can people get involved in Startup Lounge?
Sign up. It's free. We don't charge anything to anybody except for our sponsors. They help pay for the events. So you sign up, you create a free profile, and then once you're in that profile, if you want to use or take advantage of one of our events, you can just register right online. Our podcasts are available directly on our website and through iTunes, and we're actually starting to do them from live locations, which is interesting because that means I have to put on the filter because when you have other people listening, there's no edit button.
Less editing.
People remember what you said and what a horrible thing that you said. So,
how often are you doing the podcast now?
We're probably down to about once every 2 months or so. We used to, when Scott was unemployed, do them once every 3 weeks or so. Right. But you know, now that he's busy building Star Pound and having some enormous success with it. You know, Scott is going to be one of the most important technology entrepreneurs in the Southeast in 3 years. Mark my words. I mean, yeah, I'm a big fan, but I think that's an objective position.
Okay, so what's the website?
Startuplounge.com.
Startuplounge.com. All right, well, Michael, this has been very informative, and I know our listeners are going to get a lot of good information, and you'll probably be swamped with folks signing up at Startup Lounge.
Hope so.
All right, well, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been another issue of Launch with Ron Reardon and Lee Cantor.